From the Jesuits of Canada and the United States, this is AMDG. I'm Mike Jordan-Lasky. The NCAA women's and men's basketball tournaments start this week, and when you pair this fact with Holy Week's arrival on Sunday, it's as sacred a time as there is on the American Jesuit calendar. Okay, just to be clear for those of you who don't have a sense of humor about church stuff or who don't like basketball for some inexplicable reason, I'm not saying Holy Week and the tournament are equally important, but basketball is a rich tradition at so many of our Jesuit colleges and universities. There are three Jesuit schools who have both their men's and women's teams in the Big Dance this year, including Omaha's Creighton University. And my guest today is none other than Creighton President Father Daniel Hendrickson, SJ. While I'm sure Father Hendrickson is pumped up for both Blue Jays teams this March, today's episode isn't about basketball at all. It's about the roles of Jesuit colleges and universities in our world today. I spoke with Father Hendrickson a couple of months ago about his book, Jesuit Higher Education in a Secular Age, which explores how Jesuit education can help students create meaningful connections in our highly self-centered, transactional era. I asked Father Hendrickson about the book's primary intellectual influence, the peerless contemporary philosopher Charles Taylor. We also talked about the history of Jesuit education and how its vision of educating the whole person stands in contrast to the epidemic of siloed academic departments we see so often today. Father Hendrickson is an incredibly thoughtful leader, and it was a lot of fun to pick his brain about the past, present, and future of Jesuit higher ed. Enjoy the Creighton games and the rest of March Madness, and thanks so much for joining us. Well, Father Daniel Hendrickson, welcome to AMDG. Thanks so much for taking the time. How are you?
Very well. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the invitation to talk with you today.
No, absolutely. I'm glad that you could fit in this conversation. As you were saying before we started recording, as university president, you're on the road a lot, and we're catching you kind of in the middle of your travels here this time of year. So thanks for fitting me in between flights.
Yeah, no, happy to be here.
So I asked you on to talk about some of the themes you write about in your book that came out just relatively recently, last year, Jesuit Higher Education in a Secular Age, a response to Charles Taylor and the crisis of fullness. So maybe we could just start, I was curious for you, what trends in higher education, both for students and institutions themselves, made you want to write this book now?
It's a good question. I will tell you this, a trigger point for getting the book actually completed, to get into the serious work of it and finishing it, was actually COVID. So my life as a university president calls me in various directions, the daily operations of the university, some of the other points of internal focus, and then a lot of, as you mentioned, the travel and the networking, the connection with alumni bases. But it seems that there's always a full slate of things to do during the course of the day, and then the evenings are always booked as well. So COVID released at least the evenings, and I had time to dive in and get to this book, which I've been wanting to do for a long time. I will tell you that there's two passions that come together in this. One is the work of Charles Taylor and his terrific magnum opus, perhaps, A Secular Age, published in 2007. And then my own love for Jesuit education, Jesuit higher education in particular. And I just think part of my interest was trying to speak to what I find is lots of different synergies between the hopes, the goals, the values of Jesuit education and what Taylor is trying to diagnose or speak to in A Secular Age. One concept in particular, the one I focus on and really develop my own thinking through my own book, is the concept of fullness. I can come back to that a little bit later if you'd like. More to your question, to some of the trends or interests, concerns of higher education today, you know, Jesuit higher education, we think and feel we have a special niche in the work of higher education, transforming individuals' lives and focusing so intently, earnestly on the formation of individuals for developing into people will become agents of change and go out and you know, make the world a better place. And before doing so, garner a tremendous sense of self-awareness and self-esteem and confidence and value. Education without that can feel transactional, you know, not formational, so to speak, but just the work to get a degree and go out and get a job. I'm simplifying that, of course, to some extent, but Jesuit education layers so much other on top of that.
What about, for folks who might not be familiar with Charles Taylor, obviously we don't have space to get deep into Charles Taylor or his concept of fullness. With, again, that book itself is magisterial. He's written just thousands of pages. It's impossible to summarize. But what about Taylor's work maybe briefly really captures your imagination? And then what about specifically this the concept of fullness that you kind of develop and bring into conversation with Jesuit higher ed, again, really attracted you? So if you could just bring us into the book a little bit.
I got ordained in 2006, went off to East Africa for a year to teach philosophy in Tanzania at a place actually not run by the Society of Jesus, but a place that needed philosophical instruction, and then came back to New York City to enroll at Columbia in a PhD program called Philosophy of Education, or Philosophy and Education. I really wanted to write on Ignacio Echeverria as a philosopher, priest, president of the UCA, his life, a story of liberation, philosophy. But Charles Taylor's book was published in that year, A Secular Age, 2007, and I just dove into it. I read it. It's 900 pages. I read it in one, actually, faculty group from Columbia and NYU and Barnard. The four of us, I was a doc student, they were all faculty. We just went through it page by page and finished it. And the next day I read it with a group of Jesuits I was living with. I was just really taken with the concept of fullness of this. Taylor trying to say that, well, in my words, that God is just trying to break through any and all of our lives in any given moment of the day. And that there are individuals and times and circumstances when that feels very real and someone can articulate this moment of grace or consolation. Taylor's depiction of it is very epiphonic, but I've had those moments and they're wonderful and they're fleeting, but they can be defining and lead someone on in life. Taylor starts with that on page 5 of the 900 pages of A Secular Age and kind of keeps referencing it, but then just at the end of that long narrative of philosophical history comes back to the concept of fullness. So I tease through that and try and articulate what does Taylor mean by fullness in traditional manifestations of it, and then more expanded versions of it today in our own lives. So I develop what's called the pedagogies of fullness, a pedagogy of study, which focuses on the self, a pedagogy of alterity or even solidarity, which focuses on others, and a pedagogy of grace, which focuses on an other or an ontic reality, as Taylor would say, or a transcendent reality or a God in our lives. So what in Jesuit higher education helps us in these important kind of realities? I define fullness, in my interpretation of Charles Taylor's fullness, as a deeply relational concept. So as a way to connect to ourselves, to others, and another. And Taylor says in A Secular Age, we're losing that. We're losing this ability to connect and relate.
Why do you think that is, we're losing that ability? And then also I feel like a university is kind of bringing people together the way it does and what it hopes to do might be an antidote or offer several ways of kind of combating that decline. Any sense, what does Taylor say? What do you think? What have you seen about why are we losing this sense to really connect with self, others, and an other? And then, yeah, what is university doing about that?
I'll start with Taylor and then see if I can get to my own rendition of that. But Taylor will blame the project of modern philosophy, and I'll turn to somebody like Rene Descartes. some commentators of modern philosophy, Stephen Toulmin, for instance, in his great book, Cosmopolis, will say philosophy took a wrong turn at modernity and followed the pathway of Descartes. You know, that human persons, individuals are thinking things disconnected from the other important realities of our lives. And that knowledge is what's based on facts and evidence and what's proven and true, whereas others of us would say that knowledge and understanding come through so many other kinds of intellective sources in our lives. St. Ignatius of Loyola says the same thing, by the way. The emotional realities of our lives are important information for understanding ourselves and others and God. So at any rate, modern philosophy, you know, kind of led us down this path toward kind of the individualistic reality of our lives and what we know and how it can be proven and based on evidence and facts. Clearly, some of that's true and meaningful and scientific. So that's one place that Taylor tries to unpack and help us appreciate and understand. An alternative, by the way, is someone like Michel de Montaigne, who I talk about in my book, a philosopher around the same time of modernity, who talks about the need to essay ourselves. So he writes the essays, and that, you know, it's less about being dead certain on knowing something and more about just kind of finding our way in the world and keep knowing and keep growing and keep evolving. I also think there's space in Jesuit education for recognizing that. So that's all the Taylor platform. As you arc toward today and just recognize, at least in Western society or at least in US Western society, the importance of being independent and invulnerable, strong individuals, and then living in this kind of age or time of instant gratification, Amazon.com and social media, and lack of other kinds of meaningful relationships and connections in our lives. I think all of that works together in interesting ways. I would hope that in the project of Jesuit education, as we can keep reinforcing the need and importance of relationships and connecting. And that's what my pedagogy of fullness try to achieve through the pedagogy of self, other, and another, or study alterity and grace.
I'd love your hear a response from you on, so this is a Jesuit high school talk, but I think the Jesuit high schools, I think they, you hear all the time about what they call the grad at grad, the graduation, the graduate at their graduation. And there's five characteristics. You just see them plastered on Jesuit high school walls, right? And these are the five, if folks aren't familiar. It's open to growth, intellectually competent, religious, loving, and committed to doing justice. And I'm curious how you might like adapt or add to them, or just respond to them somehow when you're thinking about a graduate of Creighton or another Jesuit university.
Well, I like those so very much. And you walk around any of our campuses, whether it's secondary education or higher education, we just have so many characteristics and virtues and ideals and aspirations of Jesuit education. I think ultimately, at least through this book and in today's conversation, I'm very interested in the way Jesuit education can and should cultivate a deep sense of personal awareness in each of our own lives, and hopefully an awareness of gifts and talents and limitations and vulnerabilities and what we're good at and how we can grow and evolve as human persons. Part of that process of self-awareness, I think, is it is and should recognize is how we're very special and unique and loved by God, and that we're called forward by such a God to do what we can in the world with our gifts and talents as we keep growing and gaining more gifts and talents, which leads to that really wonderful possibility that any of us can be agents of change in a world that's bleeding and blistering and needs our care and attention to, you know, to help God make this a better place for all of us.
I'm curious about like what some of these things look like practically for you, or kind of in your leadership, would have been things you've wanted to value to sort of really put flesh on these ideas, right? Because we know so often that when you think about college, it's yeah, as you were saying before, it's training to get a job. It's an opportunity to then make the most money. It can feel sort of transactional. There does seem to be that sort of pressure that we are, you know, preparing people for the, you know, for the workforce. And even for me as an English major, like our liberal arts, you know, college at our university was stressing, you know, liberal arts majors get great jobs too, having to kind of defend it that way. And I certainly understand a lot of parents, you know, they're paying a lot of money for their kids to go to these schools and want their kid to be set up for life in a certain way. But when that is such a market pressure, how do you stay relevant and appealing to young people and their families while also suggesting another way or more or something different?
I started as president of Creighton University in 2015, so I'm in my ninth year. I had been at Creighton years earlier teaching in the Department of Philosophy. Much more recently, I was invited by my predecessor president to be a trustee of the institution, and then became president a year or two later. So I came to a university that I recognized as strong and powerful in the professions, especially in business, law, and the health sciences. In the spectrum of Jesuit higher education in North America, or at least for the US, I should just say for the 27 of us, only four of us have medical schools. A couple of others are stepping forward to build and certain kinds of medical schools. Only three of us have dental schools today. A lot of us, but not all of us, have business schools and law schools. But Creighton has all of that, and so it's a point of expertise and strategic initiative, point of interest for our students. 65% of 1,100 students coming to Creighton as freshmen each year, 65% will express some sort of interest in health sciences. Our business education has doubled in the past decade from like 550 to almost 1,200 students in business. I also knew that Creighton, you know, as a member of the humanities faculty years ago, Creighton is also really good in the arts and the sciences and teaching humanities. So I came to Creighton as president and I said I wanted to focus on two particular presidential initiatives or priorities. One of them is the study importance, the role of the humanities, which you look around the U.S., you look at institutions, especially those who are in trouble, and if they have to cut costs, is the first thing they do is start eliminating programs in the humanities. We haven't done any of that except to build and expand and express the interest and the importance of the humanities. So since 2015, for instance, we started the Kingfisher Institute in the liberal arts. We parked it in a new school of dentistry, kind of intentionally or symbolically. And it helps kind of bring the humanities into other places of the university. One manifestation of that work has been the startup of the medical humanities program, which we have in both of our campuses, in the medical school in Omaha and also the one in Phoenix. The Phoenix piece we can talk about later if you're interested.
I do want to ask about Phoenix. I do want to ask you about that. Hey, keep going.
And so we have done a lot of work just to showcase the importance of the humanities, not only for their core curricular role in the fundamental reality of being educated in a Jesuit Catholic institution, but also just across the curricula of the university and the programs and events. Secondly, my other point of interest was global education. Some of that, to be honest, Omaha is a very terrific place. Not everybody knows that about Omaha, Nebraska. It's a great city, and Creighton is a really beautiful campus. We continue to transform that campus in interesting ways too, especially in the last few years. We're kind of in a moment, Mike, of the campus evolving and changing, and it just looks terrific, and there's more to come. But I've done a lot of global travel myself with the Jesuits as a young Jesuit, always in these really interesting global locales, global places in a really local context. So being with Jesuits in their schools and their parishes, if not with families associated with the Jesuits. And we all know Kolvenbach's reality is to get out and better understand the world around us. We overquoted, but he talks about knowing the gritty realities of the world. I was sold the minute I heard that. And I want more and more of our students, as many as possible, to get out and understand the way the world works, better understand the world they come from and the way really the world around us functions and operates. And I think that's an important proficiency to gain. So I think that that has lended itself to certainly the importance of my leadership and our work at Creighton these past few years.
As I mentioned, I am curious about the medical campus in Phoenix. And as you were talking about the real, you know, the tradition of excellence in these kind of professions and the professional areas. And that was in the back of my head as I was reading the book, because as you're writing in the book, talking about, you know, this critique of the over-specialization and even the idea of like a college major, you know, that you've got to really pick one thing and focus on it. And then how that leads to then like departments kind of being siloed and not really working together. And then also, again, this professional education has like kind of supplanted that like holistic liberal arts education. And I'm just curious for you then how that critique goes with this opening of a kind of specialized medical education campus in Arizona. You could see how how do those fit together for you as two kind of different priorities that could feel different? They see like, are these going in the same direction or are they in different directions? So yeah, how do you describe how those work together?
Well, in one way, I'll backpedal into it, because in coming back to Creighton in 2015 as president, I recognized kind of a special pedagogy within our health sciences platform, which is this, is that Creighton has expertise in interprofessional education in the health sciences, which is a collaborative care model. It's a model that's been around for a long time, but Creighton has kind of owned it and packaged it in a very special way, which is to say this: we celebrate the vocation of our medical students who want to be doctors and go out and heal people. The same with nurses, the same with the therapists and others in allied health and pharmacy. If you go through all of those programs we have, there's a special vocation to what that student is studying. But we also put them in the same spaces to crosstalk and do case studies and figure out if there's a situation of back pain, does this need surgery? Does it need physical therapy? Does it need a social worker? You know, what are the ways toward healing this individual? And we've also done studies which showcase that bringing these fields of study and inquiry in the health sciences together creates more affordable healthcare in the end, more efficient healthcare, and it's more personal to the needs of the patient, which I think is more true to a mission like Creighton University. So with that said, we're kind of all already defined in a norm of university education, which is stay in your own silos and your own disciplines. The decision to go to Phoenix was hand in hand with being called to be there. And Creighton took a phone call in 2005, two presidents before me, from a woman working at St. Joseph's Hospital and Medical Center, which interestingly was founded by the same Mercy Sisters who founded our hospital in Omaha, St. Joseph's, like 140 years earlier. They wanted an academic relationship. They wanted primarily medical school to come in to help work in the hospital. And we jumped at it. So we sent something like four or five students in 2005, medical students, for summer rotations. And that just instantly evolved into Creighton sending 40 M3 students who would stay on, do clinicals for a full year, and then stay on for their fourth year. And then we send in another 40 or 41 M3 students. So that buildup, by the time I got to Creighton in 2015, I and we and my team were asking the questions, what are the next meaningful steps? As folks in Phoenix were saying, we love Creighton students. They're different. They stand out in our hospitals. Can you do more and can you hurry up and do more? So that led to a series of decisions to expand our partnerships. So it's St. Joe's Hospital Medical Center, it's Valleywise Hospital, it's District Medical, Dignity Medical, St. Vincent de Paul. And these partnerships have just really helped us build this brand new campus. So in Phoenix, we can accommodate 1,000 new learners, half of which are students of medicine, a full four-year medical school, and then the nursing and allied health programs and physician assistant program. And in many ways, there's something kind of true to a sense of being Jesuit or being called to a place that needs something to help strengthen the locale it goes into. So people who are wanting what we do, we're helping develop a workforce. Phoenix is entrepreneurial, innovative in so many ways. It lacks healthcare education. Phoenix is the fastest growing city in the United States. It's the fourth largest city at something like 5 million and due to double by 2040. And we're there to help provide more healthcare professionals. And to do so through, you know, sensibilities of who we are as Jesuit and Catholic and these aspirational realities of wanting to transform our students' lives and help them transform the world.
Sure. So yeah, even the way you describe like trying to bring these folks together or disciplines together and to have dialogues across some disciplines and the like real kind of power in that. As I'm reading the book, I just kept thinking over and over again about one class I had in college, which was the most powerful experience of my life, educational experience that I will never forget. This class was unbelievable. It was kind of a college seminar, which for a lot of professors, they just kind of mailed in, but it was taught by the dean who invented the college seminar. And so it was, again, at a Catholic university, not Jesuit, and it was philosophy, theology, literature, film, all seminar discussion based. We went to play together, like music, and it was bringing your own faith journey into dialogue with these great works. And that wasn't off the table, you know, because was putting those things into, we felt like we could do that at a Catholic university. It was this integrated thing where like we, in terms of meaning and our own sense of self, all the things you're talking about in fullness, I was like, yes, this was that experience for me over and over. I texted a picture of the book to the teaching assistant in that class because we're still close and we're close with a number of us from that class are still close. One semester, that was it. And I had no other class that was even anything like in the same universe, even at this, you know, nice Catholic university. And I just like, for me, I've often wondered like since then, like why wasn't every class at a Catholic university like that? What was I missing? Like, I took like a pretty wide variety of things, but I never found anything that like captured my imagination or made me feel a lot as alive as that. And like, so what are the challenge? What are the barriers that are preventing even like places that put this in their mission from living it more? What are some of the forces that are working against it? We've talked about some of them, but I don't know. Does any of this resonate with you in terms of someone trying
very,
to do these things?
Very much so. Yeah, that class just sounds rich and wonderful. And
it's called Faith, Doubt, and Reason.
Pursuit.
Oh,
faith, right.
Oh, yes, it was so good.
Terrific.
Yeah.
I tell you, you know, we still live in long-term categories about faculty compensation and you know, units and credits that students need, and we're kind of stuck in a certain model. There's lots of literature just in the past couple of years to say we need to really push beyond that. But you know, higher education as an institution kind of prides itself on a sense of history, but you know, in some ways we haven't changed in thousands of years in some of the most basic things that we do. We do it well, but there's opportunities to keep growing and expanding, being innovative in the work of transforming lives, of doing education.
I do want to ask about in terms of those things, those traditions that have gone back thousands of years, and maybe we don't change and we need to look at some of those things. But also, I think in the book, you show how the kind of the intellectual history of education and what it means to educate and what our goals are, what some of the trends were 500 plus years ago that inspired the Jesuits, and how the Jesuits are at first weren't even really all that interested in education, and only when that seemed like it was a need, and then they started to develop a system of it, and the network of schools spread rapidly. But I really love that section of your book, because I think so often for us here today, as we think Jesuits, we think education, and then we, you know, maybe some of the catchphrases that go along with that, you know. But I think you really kind of show some of that, like the depth and how it was innovative at the time. And then even today, how some of those things that inspired the earliest Jesuit educators could continue to inspire not just Jesuit schools, but others today. So could you maybe go through some of the most important values or themes or things you saw from your research in early Jesuit education and its history that could be helpful today?
If a point of pride in my book is unpacking is at least introducing folks to Charles Taylor and unpacking in a deeper way the sense of what fullness is. The other hopefully gift of it is articulating something of the origins of the Society of Jesus, or St. Ignatius of Loyola, experiences in his life after, you know, that cannonball moment and his convalescence, and what emerges as the biggest and yet widest network of education the world has known, Jesuit education. And so I took great delight in trying to better understand the parts and pieces that make all of that come together. The important part of that story is St. Ignatius of Loyola. They say he had two conversions, actually. One is, you know, through the cannonball and being hurt and going through that experience of thinking about his life. The second is realizing a few years later, giving something of the spiritual exercises to folks and wanting to enlighten others about the importance of God in their lives and recognizing God in the world around us, is knowing after too many encounters with the Inquisition, he needed education. So maybe the second more important conversion is his decision to go to the University of Paris, probably the best of what the world had to offer in education at the time, which is why years later, Paul III recognizes in 1440 with St. Ignatius and Francis Xavier and Bobadilla and the other first Jesuits, he had some of the best trained clergy, you know, in his workforce. And so and told them, you need to get into the work of education. But what happens at the University of Paris is an important part of my book, and the changes in pedagogy and curriculum and instruction. And so Ignatius had something of the good and the bad of medieval education and scholasticism, and then the good and the bad of new and innovative approaches, which maybe weren't so new and innovative because it was Renaissance humanism. It was going back to the wisdom and value of the Greeks and Romans and how they educated in a more holistic approach. And so there's lots of different realities to how that works and functions, but I think it's an important part of who we are today, in fact, is that Renaissance humanism is the foundation, the bedrock of Jesuit education. I love the fact that Ignatius or the Pope Paul III, you know, some of us, a lot of people only know the Jesuits as educators. And yet it's Pope Paul III who said, you need to get into the work of education.
I think for at least one figure in your book, an early Jesuit figure, who in his kind of approach to evangelizing and to just essentially being a Jesuit, felt like it was kind of consonant with kind of some of the major themes in your book, is Matteo Ricci. Is it maybe a Jesuit who is an underappreciated one and is not yet canonized, but maybe someday. Can you talk a little bit about him and how you find his example particularly inspirational today?
I think Ricci demonstrates for us the best of Jesuits and those who work in Jesuit ministries are going into new cultures and customs and to try to appreciate and respect what all that means in a foreign context. Instead of, for instance, just kind of transplanting something of our lives in one location to a different location. So Ricci is kind of this ideal for foreign ministry and going abroad and working. And, you know, he did, there's so much to know about him and penetrating the Ming Dynasty of China, which was so xenophobic, and yet he was able to bring the conversations, tools, science, learning, culture, beliefs of Western culture into conversation with that dynasty, and then to share that through writings back to Jesuit headquarters in Rome, which would then disseminate in other ways to folks reading those letters. But so Ricci demonstrates just this kind of this global thrust or global outreach, which I think has started. The global interest of the Society of Jesus begins almost the minute that the Jesuits are approved as the Society of Jesus, and St. Francis Xavier, you know, is on his way to the port at Lisbon and the Portuguese trade routes over to India, So we're almost global as we were the Jesuits to begin with. But Ricci is a fascinating character, isn't he?
Yeah, it's
Taylor,
ahead of his time.
Apologies for the interruption.
No.
Taylor ends, when Taylor writes 900 pages, you know, 850 of them are kind of the slog through history and philosophy and art and architecture. I've never backpedaled, backpaged through a book as much as I had through Taylor, just to try and say, wait, what did he say? And then, you know, and then he'd have like four or five pages where he's just masterful on Immanuel Kant or something like that. Just eloquent and never said better by anyone else. But when he gets to the last chapter, I forget what it's called. It might even be like an epilogue. It's almost like he goes from his study to the kitchen table. The conversation, the tone just changes. It's just relaxed and interesting. But he talks about, he says, the world today needs a Matteo Ricci. It needs somebody who can take a, you know, a set of, whoever's Jesuit or Catholic or whatever that is, you know, if that's our interest, into a different foreign context, even if that's actually closer to us than we realize. Younger people, a different generation. And how can we speak with and inspire others, learn who they are in a very genuine, open-hearted, open-minded way, but then also share something of what we believe about what's important in life. So Taylor's, when he gets to that last chapter, there's so much more I could say about that too. Like when he says the world is, you know, it's too secular and we've lost the sense of an ontic reality or a transcendent power, or what he should say or could say is God, he kind of says, everyone needs to read more Gerard Manley Hopkins. I love Hopkins. So, you know, for I'm like, oh my gosh, say more.
Right.
So God's Grandeur and Kingfisher's Catch Fire and go on and on about these great, beautiful Hopkins poems. But this technique, which the poetic technique of Hopkins is really to try and help us to recognize the presence of God in our lives, which is what Taylor wants to do. And he says, there's got to be new and different and myriad ways of achieving that. Somebody like, Ricci is a paradigmatic figure who at least tried to achieve that in his ministry and stepping into the lives of others.
I can only imagine for you as a Jesuit excited about this stuff, reading it, and then you're seeing Jesuits on the page. You're picking up the phone, call, hey, check this out. You won't believe this.
I was able to, in 2007, when the book came out, I was a first year doc student at Columbia. Taylor spoke at Columbia three times a year. He spoke at NYU. He spoke at New School. So I was just like stalking him all over New York City. He went to Boston College, and I have a friend and mentor and others there. So I was invited actually to have dinner with him at Boston College. I saw him up at Fordham. It was wonderful. And I kind of forget the point I'm trying to make at that, but it's more than just following them all.
Well, right. No, but to see, again, like to see, I love, what I love about reading when you find something is that like to feel like someone reaching out to you and, you know, saying me too, or you recognize your own soul on the page, or just like there's that connection through space and time with
yes.
someone else.
And actually, here's the point I was trying to make. So I really took a point of trying to understand, you know, Taylor's life beyond his writing. He was invited with John Paul II into a think tank early in John Paul II's papacy to actually to help the Pope and his cabinet, so to speak, think about, you know, the world and ask questions about secularism well before Taylor is writing about secularism. Taylor is, you know, a longtime professor at McGill University, kind of a Harvard of Canada, but also friends with the Jesuits in Montreal. And I'm led to believe in kind of part of a faith sharing group with either one or some Jesuits and then others as part of that kind of Ignatian family there. So this is all to say is I was so just compelled by his work, and just as happens, see, any of us want to learn more about his personal life. Yeah. I think too, the intersections between Ignatian sensibility, from the spiritual exercises of the Jesuits, consolation and grace, and how that intersects with Taylor's descriptions of fullness. I just thought there are just so many rich synergies. I just want to keep exploring.
No, and I appreciate all the synergies here in this conversation and in the book, and the way you bring into dialogue so many different eras and writers and put them, you know, together in this way and in conversation with this, you know, with the question of higher ed today and Jesuit higher ed in particular. So yeah, doing a lot of great helpful work in the book. But before I let you go, as the president of Creighton during basketball season, with two teams both in the top 25, playing very well so far, what can we look for? Give us your scouting report. Are we going to see two Final Four teams this year? That's possible, isn't it?
I'm really hoping so. It'll be not March Madness, but in Jesuit terminology, March Magus.
Well, right now, in the women's poll, Creighton, Marquette, and Gonzaga, as we're speaking, are all next to each other, the three Jesuits in that the women's poll. So there is some Magus going on there.
That's right. No, I'm hopeful. It's both the men's and women's teams in the last couple of years, both Sweet 16 or Elite 8 in one year or the other. And great coaching, great players, great programs. I'm excited.
Yeah, I mean, you see Creighton on TV, Creighton basketball. It's like, where are all these people coming from? It's a huge arena. It's like this devoted fan base. It's a pretty cool part of the community, certainly. And I imagine it's something you lean into as president, despite sometimes the way
I love
athletics
it.
Can take over. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. We joined the Big East in 2013, so the renewed or reconfigured Big East, mm-hmm. which has been terrific. And it's 10 schools and back to 11 with UConn joining. But it's been a great group of presidents with a tremendous amount of institutional affinity, very successful program, three championships, national championships on the men's programs in the last 7 years. So it's been exciting. It's called us to be more competitive and better, I think, in our own ways. And we're proud to be part of that group.
Well, Father Daniel Hendrickson, thank you so much for taking the time. And thanks again for sharing the book and for your reflections today.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
AMDG is a production of the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the United States and recorded at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. The show is edited by Marcus Bleach. Our theme music is by Kevin Lasky. The Jesuit Conference communications team is Marcus Bleach, Eric Clayton, Megan Leepsch, Becky Sindelar, and me. Connect with the Jesuits online at jesuits.org, on Twitter at Jesuit News, Instagram at WeAreTheJesuits, and facebook.com/Jesuits. Sign up for weekly email reflections by visiting jesuits.org/weekly. If you or someone you know might be called to discern a vocation with the Jesuits, connect with a Jesuit vocation promoter at beajesuit.org. Drop us an email with questions or comments at media@jesuits.org. You can subscribe to AMDG on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as St. Ignatius of Loyola may or may not have said, go and set the world on fire.